Many supplements on the market are hard to absorb or packed with fillers, but that's not the case with Quiksilver Scientific. Quiksilver Scientific is a U.S.-based company that manufactures advanced liposomal supplements, making nutrients easier for your body to absorb and put to work quickly. Made in Colorado in an NSF GMP-certified facility and rigorously tested, this is science-first supplementation. After adding ultravitamin into my routine, recovery feels faster and I don't hit that midday crash anymore. Trusted worldwide for supplements that truly make a difference in performance, resilience, and well-being. Quiksilver Scientific makes advanced liposomal supplements so you can actually feel the difference. Energy, focus, calm, recovery. Get 10% off plus free shipping at tryqs.com/podcast. That's tryqs.com/podcast. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
This is a More Than Just Podcast production.
Welcome to Spotcast Season 8, Episode 13. My name is Tim Mitra. I am in Toronto, Ontario, and I'm joined by Jonathan Kuhlein once again in Florenceville, Bristol.
New Brunswick, Canada, Earth.
Earth.
Milky Way.
Milky Way, solar system. Solar system, Milky Way.
Hello there, kids.
And we're also joined by Hyman Lopez Jr. in Seattle, Washington.
How's it going?
Well, if you're a Blue Jays fan, Jaime, it's going very, very well.
Very well. Thanks for asking.
As we record things here, the World Series, that, mind you, because we have been off for a couple weeks here, sits with your Toronto Blue Jays. You know, valiantly defeated the Mariners in a Game 7, and I think you're hoping for just a Game 6 in this World Series here, right? Not a 7?
Yeah. That would be ideal, yes.
All of the championships at the Toronto teams have won in the last umpteen years. We're in Game 6, but you know, it's Toronto. They have the ability to lose two games in a row.
So I think we have a little housekeeping that we need to do before we get into this week's episode. Yeah. Because I believe we had a wager between Jaime and I about the Mariners versus Blue Jays American League Championship Series.
Yep.
I said a prayer actually in our group chat the night that they were playing with the Blue Jays, had a chance to win in Game 7. I said a little prayer to Baby Jesus to please not make me have to watch a Tom Cruise movie. it's actually, I could put a screenshot up. It's actually in our Slack chat for just the three of us. Without exaggeration, it was about 45 seconds after I posted that George Springer ripped a home run that won them the game. So Jesus does not like Tom Cruise is, I think, what the moral message is here. But most importantly, I don't have to watch Tom Cruise movie, but we get to select some delightful entertainment for Jaime to watch. And I reviewed some suggestions that his significant other has made as to things that he would not enjoy. And I must say, I think this one is a slam dunk of all these choices. Now, don't get me wrong, the Step Up movies look terrible, but I really feel like we're somewhere else with the Cats movie, the one with Taylor Swift and Idris Elba.
Oh, right. Oh,
that just looked exquisitely bad. Now,
and not anatomically correct either. Yeah.
Maybe on the unintentional comedy scale, it would be good, but I can't tell you folks how happy I am to announce. I'm happy to announce that Jaime will be doing a review of the Cats movie in an upcoming episode of Spotcast for us.
There you go. Let me see. Does Just Watch break out the like CGI bungles versus non-CGI bungles edition? Let me see where to look at this. Okay, excellent. One sec. Cats 2019. There were a variety of choices here, folks, as I'm looking this up.
To be fair, he did. He gave us some good choices here. These were provided after a helpful confab with Jaime's significant other. But a lot of these movies were actually like decently highly rated, in spite of not necessarily fitting Jaime's love of this particular genre here and there. But the lowest rated thing on here was Cats. And I must admit, yeah, I've been curious to watch that one because I've heard it is epically bad. So
I have three words for you guys. Dame Judi Dench.
I can't, it's actually got a great cast, but man, it looks bad.
I remember the scathing reviews at the time.
Was it all where their bungholes?
Pretty much, yeah.
I guess it'll have to be Amazon. The Just Watch, unfortunately, is very confusing here. Where I was like,
I'm sure you can buy it on iTunes. Don't be playing this game.
Was it on Hulu? And it was like, you can watch similar movies on Hulu. I'm like, that's not what I want from Just Watch. I'm supposed to be looking at a movie and you tell me where I can watch the movie, not, hey, there's something similar here. I have the Rotten Tomatoes score here. What was it, like
19, I believe, is the
19% from the critics and 53% from the audience.
Good news, it's available in 4K if you get it through the Apple TV store.
There you go.
Because you're going to want to see that in 4K. Here's the lineup. Taylor Swift, Idris Elba, Judi Dench, Jennifer Hudson, James Corden, Jason Derulo, Ian McKellen, Rebel Wilson. Like, it's arguably a pretty good cast.
Yeah, that's like a real murderer's row. You know, if this is a baseball team, they'd be like, man, that's definitely going to be all home runs all the time, right? And who's the team that doesn't win kind of thing. That's amazing. So, yeah, there you go. You know, the one thing I was kind of wondering about is, and I'm totally fine either way. Like, I'll believe you, gentlemen. Did we ever resolve the, I believe, circa 2022 wager, which went the opposite direction for the Mariners?
I don't remember if we made one, because I don't think I had very much faith in that particular Blue Jays team. I think I was like, I guess the Mariners are moving on. This time it actually felt competitive. Both the teams felt like either one of them could have won. And honestly, like, it was one bat swing away from being a Mariners Dodgers final for sure. So, that 22 team, they sort of fumbled backwards into the playoffs. So I really didn't have a lot of faith in that one. But if you want, I can, you know, I'm happy to do a make good as long as it's not, you know, an excruciating one.
Yeah, had the wager gone my way on this, I would have done Mummy 2017
for, like, Lord,
low quality and fits into the theme of Spockcast, and then kind of like, bro, what happened here? That was a cinematic universe that they desperately were trying to get started at Universal. So,
well, I tell you what, folks. So as we record this, we're right at the end of October. I have agreed reluctantly to participate in Movember this year alongside my son. We're going to do Movember, which involves me shaving my beard and mustache off for the first time in years and years and years, just to take part. And then we're going to do this thing. We're going to try and raise some money for men's health charities. If anybody wants to participate, I'll put a link into our Slack channel, or you can hit me up at the addresses we give at the end of the show. Make a donation. We get to the right number and I'll take one for the team and watch Tom Cruise's awful mummy movie. Hmm. And I'll do it with a really funny looking mustache.
Yeah. I thought I picked a different Tom Cruise movie is probably the one I would choose. I haven't seen The Mummy though.
Yeah, Tim, what would you have done? Because it was a challenge, and I think the other time of the show I even asked, you know, various AIs, hey, if you wanted to punish your friend who does not like Tom Cruise, what would you choose? And they did seem to circle in on Cocktail. And then if I asked them,
which, well, I did see when I was a young man,
it, yeah, was, I was not like, good, well, what then? If he already has seen that, what if it was one he hasn't seen? They kind of diverged from there.
Yeah,
yeah, I'm trying to think.
People have said, you know, when I brought this up, they're like, you know, I said, I haven't seen, was it Live, Die, Repeat? And people are like, but that movie's actually good. If they were going to torture you, they wouldn't make you watch that one. They'd make you watch a terrible one. I was like, all right, fair.
Yeah, 15% and 35% for The Mummy 2017, man.
Yeah, well, because that was supposed to be the kickoff of like a whole new monster series of movies. And it was so bad and such a bomb that it didn't do anything. So, yeah.
I would have made you watch Tropic Thunder because it's a great movie and you've not seen it.
I haven't. And I've heard good things, but I'm also like, yeah.
But Magnolia was probably the one I would want you to watch.
Hmm.
Oblivion is pretty bad too.
You have a pretty big window from, I think the last thing I saw, I think maybe the last Tom Cruise movie I saw was The Last Samurai, which for me was the last time I was going to see a Tom Cruise movie because it is horrible. And I was like, I'm out.
Oh, Eyes Wide Shut. That's the one I would want you to watch.
Oh, I've seen that one too. Because in spite of the Tom Cruise of it all, I love Stanley Kubrick. So I took one for that one. But yeah.
Apparently he's in Young Guns too. What?
I think he's just got he's only in it for a short while, I think.
Uncredited. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think Magnolia he was pretty creepy in that one.
Well, I think the moral of the story is we need more wagering on this podcast.
Yeah, I liked Vanilla Sky too, but he was particularly bad in that one. I mean, he was good. It's a great movie, but he was not likable. Anyway, but that could just be the role. All right, well, let's move on. So we did have some fact check from I don't know what I said, but the scream that's used a lot in movies is the Wilhelm scream.
Mm.
And in fact, there's a clip here. I don't know if this is from the original cut of the movie, but George Lucas used the Wilhelm scream 8 or 9 times in the original Star Wars, A New Hope.
I remember from the part where Luke and Leia are like trying to escape the stormtroopers and he shoots one of them and they fall.
Yeah, whenever somebody gets shot and falls or somebody falls off a cliff or whatever, gets knocked off, you hear this kind of scream.
Yeah.
and it's just, I think it's a free audio clip that was available to directors, and George Lucas overdid it in Star Wars. So
yeah,
it's pretty comical when you have it pointed out to you.
Yeah, it was from, I can't recall, and I'm sure this is another fact check, but it's from like an Errol Flynn movie or something from like the earlier days of film. And it just was one of those legendary, like, where did that noise come from moments that then became a meme within director circle. So then it became stuck into all these movies, right?
Well, since you mentioned it, I did do the research on it.
All right. I
checked it, but let me just call it up here.
Real-time fact check. Look at us go.
Scream. Here it is. Yeah, well, that's why I discovered when I was searching, I discovered the Star Wars clip, which I've got here in the show notes for people to listen to. It's a stock sound effect used in many films, TV programs, and other media. It's from a 1951 film called Distant Drums.
Oh, there you go.
And it was done by an actor named Sheb Woolley.
Hmm.
Yeah, so it's used in a scenario where someone is shot, falls from a great height, or is thrown from an explosion.
Personally, if I ever found myself in any of the situations, I would make that noise just for a famous ending.
And you can, I'll put a link here in the Wikipedia page too, but there's a clip of it as well. You've heard it 1,000 times. Like again, when we get to the Star Trek stuff today, that eagle scream was used again for pterodactyls.
Yeah.
Anyway, which is what led me to the comment about the Wilhelm screen. But that said, let's move on to the headlines. Jonathan's up.
Yeah, I'm going to kick us off with some Doctor Who news. So we had been talking about this when we talked about the last season of Doctor Who, which, as you'll all recall, was a co-production between BBC and Disney+. And the season ended, and it kind of ended with a what the heck kind of moment on the show, but it was even more of a what the heck moment for fans who were kind of wondering where do they go from here, because it didn't seem like it was a big hit for Disney+. And in spite of the fact that they definitely seemed like they kind of stepped up on some of the value that the money from Disney+ added. So this week we got news that they are bringing Doctor Who back, but not on Disney+. It's still going to be produced by BBC. So they announced this week that Who is going to be off for a whole nother year. So we're not getting any more Who until Christmas 2026, an episode written by Russell T. Davies himself. And they confirmed that the partnership with Disney+ is over. What that means as far as, you know, are we going to sort of just pretend that that era didn't exist? Is it going to be, you know, are we going to pick up right where we left off? Do they now have to figure out how they're going to do something with Billy Piper to make sense of the weird twist ending of the last one? Is really interesting. So again, good news if you're a Whovian, we're getting more Doctor Who. Bad news, it's going to be about 400 days from now by the time you add it all up. And it doesn't sound like we're getting another season until
We're not getting Christmas. It's not till Christmas 2026 that we're getting
Christmas 2026 is when we're getting this special. So it's a long way off, and you know, they didn't say anything in here about another season or anything more, although usually a Christmas special is a kickoff to what comes after that. And yeah, I mean, they still haven't said, you know, they didn't say anything here about Billy Piper. They didn't say anything here about a new doctor. They didn't say anything about details. They really kept it vague. So I don't know if they're going back to the drawing board or how they're approaching this, but I don't know. I mean, this seems like a pretty big gap and a pretty big deal that this partnership is kind of done too. So are you... happy, sad? Happy, sad, indifferent? I mean, I think we can all agree that the one thing the Doctor Who on Disney Plus experience brought was production
money.
Value. Production money. Value. The episodes probably looked better in the last two seasons than they did in the previous seasons by a bit of a measure.
So this is just a Chuty Gadwa series, right? Because it wasn't... Jodie Whittaker was still BBC, right?
It was. And so, yeah, it's basically the specials, the anniversary specials that they did previous to him, and then the two seasons.
Yeah, I mean, well, I mean, it's always been hard to watch Doctor Who. You know, like, you remember I used to have to watch it on PBS back in the 70s and 80s. And then it was on Space Channel, which has now been, you know, converted into something strange.
CTV Sci-Fi, I think is what they call it
now.
Yeah,
so, I still have access to that channel. But, I don't know. It's odd to not have something... for a while. But then, I mean, there was also, if you were followers of Doctor Who in the, I guess, before the Eccleston Doctor, there was quite a gap of years, right?
Yeah, I think it was 7 or 8 years or something. Yeah.
Yeah, they really struck the nail in that coffin for sure. And in fact, they don't even call it, they call this new Eccleston going forward the new Doctor Who sort of series, right? You know, even though it's been 60 years or whatever. Apparently, you can't say series without my iPad waking up. Anyway, cool.
All right.
Sad.
Yeah.
Especially since Christmas is just coming, right? So.
Yeah. So like I say, it will see you in 400 days when the next episode of Doctor Who comes around. A few episodes back, we talked about this auction that was coming up. This person who had collected massive amounts of TV memorabilia, costumes and such. And we talked about the fact there's a bunch of Star Trek costumes, there's a bunch of Batman costumes from the 1960s, I Dream of Jeannie, Get Smart, Munsters, all this classic Hollywood 1960s stuff. The auction was wrapped up this week, and man, some of this stuff really went for some bucks. Just to start out with the Star Trek of it all, given we're a Star Trek podcast and everything, William Shatner's Captain Kirk costumes, there was two of them. There was a regular one, and then there was a Mirror Mirror Alternate Universe one. The regular one went for $62,500 American, and the Mirror Mirror one went for $52,500. This is a lot of money. The Batman costumes were the real big ones from this auction. So the costumes donned by Adam West and Burt Ward together sold for $575,000. Cesar Romero's Joker costume went for $212,000. Yvonne Craig's Batgirl costume went for $87,500. I mean, these are, you know, pretty big bucks we're talking about for this stuff. So all in, including a few other costumes, you know, another Catwoman, Penguin, other stuff, almost $1 million just in the Batman costumes alone, which is a lot. An original Linda Carter signature Wonder Woman costume from the 1970s TV show, complete with the corset, the golden cuff bracelets, and her lasso of truth, was $225,000. This is quite a haul for this family of this collector that are doing this. So this was the Television Treasures Collection, and it was this doctor that had bought up Dr. Stuart Berkowitz. He passed away last year, so they sold all this collection on Heritage Auctions this week. So just to clarify, did either of you buy any of this stuff? I just wanted to double check.
With the change for the cushions, you know?
As we speak right now, Jaime is wearing his Wonder Woman costume he bought off the auction. He's very proud of it. And he looks fantastic.
At some point, you just get really bored of seeing that Rembrandt over your mantle. And you're like, you know what? I need to change some pop art, perhaps.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Not enough batarangs in your collection, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I don't know. Again, these are incredible pieces of memorabilia, but it's astonishing to me the money that gets spent on these collectibles. I mean, again, I get that they're very, very unique and very rare, and now getting really old. Some of these things are 60, 70 years old, but holy moly, the money. Crazy. All right. Next up, we got our first real trailer for Stranger Things Season 5. We had gotten teaser trailers before. We hadn't gotten any actual ones that had some dialogue and some plot and a little bit of what's actually going on. It all looks really epic and expensive and pew-pew-pewy. In this trailer, the small children you remember from Stranger Things are now, 35, 40 years old each. They look
large children. Yeah,
they look just a scotch older than they did when this series began 10 years ago. It's not like they've aged a little; they've aged a considerable amount. It's pretty funny. I really hope there are no flashbacks because it's going to look really dumb. But what did you guys think of the trailer?
Well, a lot of zombies, it seemed like, or not zombies, but those upside down guys, right? Or is it one of them or many of them?
Well, there's Vecna, who's the leader, and then there's the Demigorgons in this trailer.
Yes, I forgot. You've been catching up, so you've got all the lore.
That's true. I haven't started season 4 yet, but we'll talk about season 3 a little later in the show. But
yeah, and the young English guy that joined, I think, in the last season, who was Eddie. Possessed or something. Eddie, yeah. He didn't die at the end of the last season or whatever?
Well, spoilers, but yes, he did. He did die at the end of the last season.
Because he's in this one.
Well, it could be a flashback or it could be something else. We don't know, but he was a much beloved character. So wouldn't be surprised if we saw a few familiar faces from the past just because this is it, right? This is they're landing the plane. This is the final season.
Okay, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Jaime, what'd you think?
Yeah, looks like they're stepping up a whole bunch of stuff instead of, you know, just kids running around with bicycles and flashlights. It's like, hey, here's like an M16 and here's like, I think that was Linda Hamilton, you know, pew, pew, pews and stuff. So it definitely is nice to see a long running series like this, especially on Netflix, actually get a legit ending.
Yeah.
We'll see the quality of the ending. You know, you're always hoping for the best, but it is getting one instead of like, oh, womp, womp. They killed it in season 3 and it was a big cliffhanger, you know, very common thing. So I'm excited for this.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, so they've announced before, I thought they had just said it was going to be split in two, but it's actually going to be split in three according to this trailer. So
yeah, right.
We're getting the first chunk is coming at the end of November. The second chunk is coming on Christmas Day and the actual finale, the final episode is dropping on New Year's Eve. So yeah, it is definitely, I mean, for us, it's a good thing because it means we have something to talk about. But if you're, you know, hoping to sort of do the Netflix binge model, you're going to have to take it in pieces, which is not their usual delivery method. But I'm actually kind of grateful it is this time because if you took a look online and look at the run times for this final season, some of these episodes are more than 2 hours a piece. We're talking about like movies at this point, right?
No, it looks pretty good. I mean, I don't really do anything on New Year's Eve anyway, so this is good for me.
Yeah. This is called Old and Young People New Year's Eve. I don't want to go out. Hey, look, Stranger Things is on.
Yeah, yeah. You have to go out and be with people, you know?
Whoa, no, forget that. And last thing I got here is that this comic that we've talked about before in the past is called Something is Killing the Children. One of the sort of breakout comics of this this decade has been optioned for a movie and series adaptations by Blumhouse. So, you know, Blumhouse has sort of risen from, you know, doing, you know, sort of... We'll call them B movies, but like lower budget horror movies and things over the past, you know, number of years. And then they've started to break through with some bigger hits. Most recently, Weapons is in theaters right now, is a hit for them. They have decided to take the plunge on this franchise, which could be pretty big for them. The rumor was for a while that Netflix was very interested in developing this, and it does kind of fit a little bit. It's kind of, having just read the first book, I bought the second book, but I haven't read it yet. The there's kind of a horror vibe. It's a little bit like a darker kind of Buffy thing, but it's definitely more... it's darker for sure. So Blumhouse has got the wheels in that to do that well. So it'll be interesting to see how they approach this and then where they distribute it too, because they're talking about a theatrical release, and obviously that is what it is. But when it comes to the live action television series, where do they go from there? Where does it get distributed? It'll be interesting to see where this finally lands in the end. But yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing how this turns out, because this could be actually a pretty hot property. The comic kind of came out of nowhere as a surprise hit for Boom Publishing and took the world by storm, and it really kind of put the author James Tynion on the map. He's also written Batman and other things now. So yeah, it's got a lot of potential.
Yeah, the art looks pretty cool. It's a very distinctive look for the character with. Like a white tank top, yep. Black jeans, I think, and then the face scarf that has like demon teeth or black, yeah, with like white demon teeth or something.
Yeah, yeah, it looks like it would translate really well to the screen.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it's not prohibitively expensive. Like, it doesn't look like it would cost a fortune, which I know is a factor nowadays in the streaming wars. Is, you know, not only can we make this, but can we make this and it's not going to cost us Game of Thrones episode money or anything like that. So hopefully they do a good job and it can hit the way that the comic did.
Cool. All right. Well, mine ties back to the World Series, and I was reading in the Star the other day that after the game was over, there was a gentleman going, ex-policeman going and scooping up dirt from the pitcher's mound into 5-gallon drums, sealing them and you know, with an official seal, and sending them to wherever the World Series or the Baseball Hall of Fame or whatever is. You can buy, you can pay $50 for authentic World Series dirt. And a number of other things like cleats and you know, like Otani's uniform and things like that, and bats that were used to you know, get the famous shot, you know, the game-winning home runs and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, I just thought it was funny that, you know, $49.99 you can have some dirt. I've got some dirt in my backyard, by the way, if you want to save some money.
So let's try and circle this one. What would you do with a container full of World Series dirt? What kind of
You're going to get a little jar. You're not going to get like the 5-gallon drum.
Yeah, like how much dirt do you get for $50? Are we talking about like, you know, you could sprinkle it, or, you know, are you talking about like you could use it to plant a you know, flower in or something?
No, it just says a bottle, $49.99, a bottle of dirt, right? So in the article in the show notes, there's a picture of the gentleman duct taping the dirt in the buckets and then signing them. Right.
But even
they looked back and they thought, they looked at the, you know, the little kick plate at the top of the pitch, yeah, the pitcher's pitch.
Yeah, yeah.
And they said, hey, that's got Otani's, you know, cleat marks in it. You know, they could send that. And they hadn't even thought about selling that thing. But yeah, like, obviously you can buy the plates. You can buy home plate and first plate and, you know, third plate and all that. Third base, I mean.
Yeah.
The new thing is apparently Otani's...
cleat prints in the dirt?
No, his in the little white
in the rubber thingy, yeah, the
kick plate, yeah.
Oh,
who knew?
I'm gonna go ahead and say on the record that if I get a vial of dirt for Christmas, I'm gonna call Christmas a loss, not okay, a win.
No, you don't want a lump of coal for Christmas?
Yeah, you know, if we're gonna go back to like just raw substances, I think I can do better than just a little vial full of dirt.
Right. Okay.
Jaime, you get dirt? No? Do you want to commemorate Game 7 of the championship series? I feel like a lot of Mariners fans feel like they already got dirt for Christmas this year.
Yeah, I explained to some folks, they're like, how's it going? I was like, you know, it was a valiant loss in a very exciting series.
And I got a vial of dirt.
And, and I, you know, it is one of those, like, you know, cast it into Mount Doom to get rid of the demons or something, you know. But I did tell folks, I'm like, in all seriousness, like, I was very worried going into Game 7. I'm like, some crazy, very Mariners thing is going to happen. Some MLB blooper, like, the ball gets stuck on, like, Cal Raleigh's face mask and they can't remove it. And there's an inside the park grand slam or something crazy that's going to be on YouTube clips forever. But it didn't happen that way. And the most concrete way I can put it is, like, look, the Mariners didn't lose. The Blue Jays won, right? They legitimately played better. It wasn't like, oh, crap, we screwed it up. It's like, they just came in clutch when they needed to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What can you do about that?
Since you mentioned the demons, I think we should probably talk about the Colonel Sanders behind home plate. So it turns out that in the last two games that there was a guy wearing a Mariners jersey. He was also in behind the plate in L.A. So I don't know who that guy is, but you know, not Mariners. Marlins.
Marlins guy. Marlins guy shows up every year, no matter where they're playing. He shows up in his orange Marlins gear.
Even at like L.A.
Yep. Yep. Okay. No matter where they're playing, he shows up and he always wears that bright traffic cone looking Marlins jersey.
Yeah. And there was a guy dressed as Colonel Sanders, who was, you know, who ended his life in Mississauga, Ontario, former home of John Kuhlein. Mm-hmm. But Jonathan Kuhlein. So this colonel, so everybody was like wondering what the heck he's doing there. And there's also with the buff guy and all that kind of stuff. But turns out that KFC did actually pay the actor to dress up and got him the ticket and put him behind home plate to sell chicken, obviously, right? That was the one thing. But I had also heard that in the Nippon Baseball League, they have this forget the name of something Tigers. They have this tradition where whoever the hero of the game is, somebody will dress up as that hero and jump in some river somewhere in Japan, right? And that's been their tradition. And one time, it wasn't a Japanese player that was like a Caucasian player who became the hero of the game. So they couldn't figure out what to do. So they basically, the closest thing they could think was Colonel Sanders from KFC, because they had KFC stores by that time in Japan. So they dressed somebody up as Colonel Sanders, threw him in the river, right? And then they didn't win for like umpteen years, right? And so they were so angry about it, they threw a cement statue or a stone statue of the colonel into the river, right? And so it's known, and they eventually did fish the statue out of the river, and you can see there's pictures of it if you look on Wikipedia or whatever. But anyway, so this curse of the colonel lasted for this team for like 32 years. So the other reason why there's a Colonel Sanders behind home plate is to jinx the Japanese pitchers.
Oh, okay.
Right? Mm-hmm. Although none of the pitchers on the LA Dodgers were involved with that team or that league, maybe the league, but not that particular team. So it's kind of a funny thing. Like, yeah, they're selling chicken, but they're also, you know, they're also trying to, you know, psych out the Japanese pitchers.
I have a real-time follow-up. So the team that you're referring to, the Tigers, is Hanshin, and Hanshin actually just lost the Japan series yesterday. They lost the Japan series to the Hawks, which is really funny because it like just happened that they just also fell short again just today.
They have run recently though. Yeah.
Yeah. Fukuoka SoftBank Hawks beat the Hanshin Tigers to win the Japan series yesterday. So.
Yeah. Anyway, cool. Well, that brings us to the main part of the show, where we talk about something Star Trek related. And this week we are continuing our rewatch, first time watch. I don't know what we're calling this. You have these on some sort of media, don't you, Jonathan?
I certainly do. Series? I have the entirety of pre Paramount Plus Star Trek on DVD or Blu-ray. So I do have the very funky looking little sets that they put out during the early 2000s, and I have this one. It's actually a pretty nice set. It's got some fun behind the scenes stuff and art and all kinds of stuff.
Yeah. So with this one, we're doing season 1, episode 9, Once Upon a Planet, and as well, we're doing season 1, episode 10, Mud's Passion, which brings us round to Harcourt, Fenton, Mudd.
Once again.
Once again, yeah. So the Once Upon a Planet, basically is, I think it was one of my favorite episodes, actually, of the original series, where they go to this planet, which is supposed to be a recreational planet for shore leave. I think the episode's called Shore Leave,
it's
right?
The 14th episode of Star Trek, and it's called Shore Leave. Yep, absolutely.
Yeah,
right.
And and they, whatever they imagine is what they see, and including Sulu getting impaled by a knight charging on a on a horse, and there's a damsel in distress, and there's the White Rabbit. So I mean, they kind of replay this stuff here, and but they bring it into the sort of Star Trek trope of the computers are taking over, you know.
Yeah, it did have a recognizable, the AI is coming to get us kind of vibe, actually. I found myself going like, wow, it's prescient. The idea is that this sort of amusement park planet that they go to that is supposed to, you know, cater to the every whim of its visitors has suddenly gone haywire, and it's because the computers have decided to turn against the humans.
Yeah, they got rid of the Guardian because he got old. And
yeah, really. You know, obviously we joke about this stuff when we talked about Lower Decks, but like, this is another one of those well-worn tropes, right? You know, what if the machines take over? What if the machines come to get us? And again, this is, you know, people are freaked out about AI now and all the possibilities, the negative possibilities, but this is not a new thing, right? People were afraid of machinery a long time ago. And this is obviously captured in science fiction throughout the history of science fiction. And here we are, right?
Yeah, once again, yeah. Well, this is 73, right? But yeah, the idea that there were a lot of Star Trek episodes where some sort of, you know, society was ruled by some abandoned computer that had lost its, you know, had basically gone into it's hallucinations, which we do suffer from with the large language models, where they, you know, they predict what the next word in a sentence is going to be. And sometimes they just go off the rails, right?
Yeah.
So especially with coding, I don't know if Jaime's used it at all, but sometimes you'll be working in like one language and it'll give you an answer for a different language, you know?
Yeah. Good old hallucination type stuff. So this one, you know, I didn't remember the prior ones. I did have to look up on Wikipedia the Shore Leave thing, and I guess they did briefly mention like, oh yeah, the caretaker should be here, which I guess is a hint that they've been here before, and that was the TOS episode.
Yeah,
but right. he's died, and now the machine is just running itself. You know, he didn't you know have an opportunity to turn it off, maybe, or hand it off to somebody else, perhaps.
Yeah. And it's, yeah, so the computers can rent, I guess it's like a replicator planet they can replicate. And it's like Kirk gets his old Starfleet Academy buddy, Finnegan or something like that. It is like, you know, a sort of a bully and that kind of thing. So, yeah, it was an interesting episode. But in this one, and again, this one here, there's a section where it kidnaps Uhura and tries to convince her to help him take over the ship so he can leave the planet. I don't know how he's going to, well. Yeah, I guess he does install a computer up on the Enterprise, but in the meantime, the computer tries to do away with or eliminate, or was it turn off is the term he uses, turn off the other humans that have come down with her, and that's when the two-headed dragon and the pterodactyls appear, and of course the pterodactyls use that same eagle scream sound that I mentioned before, right?
So yeah.
Yeah. So okay, it's kind of a retelling of that episode, you know.
Yeah, generally, let's just say it's not Wrath of Khan as far as revisiting old storylines. It was not quite as grand in its scope. It would kind of just, especially if you remember the episode, it really kind of just wears over the same stuff, but also ties into the same trope of, you know, but the what if the computers were in charge? The moment for me in this episode was the introduction of Lieutenant Moress, the feline character, voiced by Majel Barrett, one of the most superfluous characters ever created in Star Trek. Really, really terrible. Really, really terrible. Just when Majel Barrett does her voice, she sort of punctuates every statement with this sort of really unappealing noise.
Yeah, it's kind of like a purr. Yeah.
It's awful. And then she comes back in the subsequent episode that we'll talk about in a second. And every time she's about to speak, I'm like, oh no.
I didn't realize you were doing a drinking game, but that makes sense.
Oh, man. Like, it's funny because, you know, obviously this is a series where, you know, we did get a lot of the original voice actors, the original actors to come back and do the voices of the real characters, which is a, you know, tremendous luxury. You know, nowadays they often just have impersonators or whatever. Sometimes we're really lucky and we get those. But it's very common in TV shows, cartoons, for one actor to do multiple voices. You might have a main character and three or four smaller characters, or you might have two or three main characters and two or three, you know, or more. You know, look at The Simpsons, look at South Park, look at, you know, so many series like that, Family Guy. Here we have Majel Barrett playing playing just this character, but then in the subsequent episode she's the ship's computer and she's Maress and she's what's her name, the blonde
Chapel,
who she actually played in the show. So it's like the Harry Mudd episode was like the all-time, you know, home run, you know, three home run game by Majel Barrett, who has a very distinctive voice.
Yeah, Nichelle Nichols plays a couple of characters. She plays O'Hara, obviously, but she also plays one of the miners.
Yeah, yeah. And again, it's fine, but she, for me, Majel Barrett has such a distinctive voice. It's just funny when she's like, "I'm doing a different voice." I'm like, "No, you're still Majel Barrett doing something else."
Yeah, she's so recognizable that way. Yeah, something in the timbre of her voice. Yeah,
yeah. But
and of course, we had Roger C. Carmel come back for for Harry Mudd, right?
Yeah, so. And that I think for me is what. I thought the first episode we watched was okay. It was okay. But the second one, I think anything with Harry Mudd is going to be a winner, but it's really a winner when Roger Carmel comes back and does the voice too, because he's just so, it's so special, right? Like, he's such a unique performer and just that big gregarious voice. It really just kind of makes the episode for me.
Yeah, that was good.
The second one, so that this is, a little more, well, it's a Harry Mudd episode, so it goes without saying it's going to be weird. The idea is that they basically are trying to track him down because he's breaking laws all over the place again, and he's got these love crystals, and the love crystals are this MacGuffin that is supposed to be, you know, the thing that is getting him in trouble, but also it turns out that it gets the ship in trouble because they get into the air vents and then everybody's having love things, but only heterosexual love. We'll talk about that one in a second.
I know, that was very much of the time. It was like, they had to make it really clear.
Like, I would have given anything to see animated Spock and Kirk just look at each other and just start going at it. Like, I mean, really, that's really where we're missing in this episode. But you're a good friend, Jim. Like, just come on. But this one really suffered from the prequel problem, especially as it happens that we're watching this on the heels of a season of Strange New Worlds, where, you know, we've seen Chapel and Spock have a romance. We've seen them, you know, the rise and fall of their relationship. And then we're supposed to also factor what happened there into the original series, where they kind of have this unrequited love thing with between Chapel and Spock, which doesn't really add up very well with what we've just seen. And then on top of that, here we double down where, like, you know, Spock ends up with these, you know, the crystals, and then he falls in love with her and is like, "My Christine, I must have her," and starts, you know, going after her. I was just like, man, there are prequel problems and there are prequel catastrophes. This one is just is climbing the rope real fast. But the biggest problem was not the prequel problem. The biggest problem was, well, these things are love crystals. They're going to make you fall in love, but not with your same sex. That's not a thing. If it's your friend, you're just like, "I admire you, good friend." That part kind of cracked me up when they're like, "I feel so good about you. I feel so good about you, too. Do you want to make out?" "No, we're just good friends.
Go get a beer."
Jaime, did this one seem problematic to you?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I got to cut it a little slack again for the era. You know, animated, so it's in the US is going to tend to be viewed as more like kid-friendly fare. So, all right. It's still kind of a funny choice, especially because it's really clear that, like, the crew are too like turned on to be effective to help the people that are on the planet. It's like, beam us back, bro. Oh, what? No, I got other things in my mind. I can't step away from this chair. Let me sit down here for a little bit. You know, like, it was really sort of a fascinating little time capsule. The monsters, the rock monsters, I think were pretty well done. As like, yeah, that's way easier to do in animation. You can make them giant, like Godzilla type monsters.
And that's where I think the animated series has always had that luxury, right? Is they can go bigger and crazier and weirder than the series ever could from the 60s.
Yeah. But by the way, in the previous episode, they had seatbelts on the bridge, right?
Yep.
Because they lost gravity at one point.
Yep. Yeah, I think this was a fun episode. But again, anything with Harry Mudd's going to be fun. As you say, you know, having Roger Carmel come back and be that voice... definitely made this episode for me, because it does immediately, it just sort of clicks you back to that nostalgia of seeing the Harry Mudd episodes of the original series. And I did love that the solution to the problem of this episode is that they're trapped on this planet, everybody's in this love haze, and Kirk starts to come out of it and is like, hey, I'll take some of these love crystals and I'll throw them into the mouth of one of these giant rock creatures. And I couldn't help but think, is he going to have sex with that creature?
Doesn't he always?
Because let's be honest, it's James T. Kirk. It's always on the table.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I was sitting there thinking, I don't remember this episode. I can't remember if this thing falls in love with him or what. And it turns out, nope. It just means that it loves him and it fights the other rock creature. Like, all right, that's a little disappointing, but sure. And in the end, Harry goes to jail, and that's all that really matters.
Well, he goes back to the Federation and got out of custody or whatever. Because his solution is always take me into custody, right?
Well, yeah. Again, the one episode is to get away from his wife, right?
Oh, yes, that's true. That's true. Cool.
Now, a word from our sponsor. Now, back to the show.
All right, well, let's move on to the Gen V season finale. Season 2, Episode 8, Trojan. And I just realized what the Trojan was. The Trojan horse metaphor. Yeah, so how did you think this... we were kind of wondering how they were going to end this series. By the way, Jaime, you can go into the cone of silence. But, how did you think they ended this one, Jonathan?
So, how they landed the final sort of conflict with Godalkin here... was not what I was expecting, but where they ended the episode was, if that makes any sense. I was not convinced that this was going to be a, like, we're going to have a big final fight against the big bad and we're going to beat him and he's done. What I had imagined was that, you know, they might have a final conflict with him in this season, but maybe he'll spin out into the larger whatever. And then my prediction was always, and they're going to hook up with the Starlighters and they're going to become part of the next season as supporting characters to the sort of the underground that's fighting back against Homelander and all that. That to me seemed like a natural place to end this. And that's kind of where we landed. But as for the final fight, you know, how that finished up, I didn't think that, given all the legwork that went into the sort of long arc of restoring Godalkin, I did not think that that character was going to be defeated so swiftly in this final episode. I kind of thought that given the powers that we'd seen, given his ability to take control of people, and I know they had sort of obviously teased the fact that if Polarity got involved, that things might fall apart for Godalkin, but... it's weird because Godalkin knew that Polarity was on the table, like that he was around and that can mess his powers up. And if his powers got messed up, then the rest of them could probably defeat him. So it seemed a little bit incongruous to me. Like, it didn't seem like that he should have been defeated quite so easily. But I think overall, like if you look at the arc of the season, the sort of progression of the characters, you know, how they, you know, sort of pushed apart and pulled together, you know, the ebbs and flows of their relationships and everything else, I would say it landed decently. It wasn't a home run, but it definitely, I think as we talked about in previous episodes, it definitely made for a solid season that is a very good companion to the boys. What you just have to bear in mind is it's not the boys.
Right. Yeah, no, for sure.
None of the actors is as good as anyone you're going to see on The Boys. None of the spectacle of it is as over the top as in The Boys. It is kind of The Boys light to an extent. And for being that, it was pretty good. And it definitely will add to your experience. If you take the time to watch this, it'll add to the experience of watching the final season of The Boys. But if you go in expecting it to be The Boys, you're probably not going to be happy.
Yeah, but I think, to be honest with you, like, I was a bit surprised by the way she does dispatch with Godolkin, right? But it's that same trope that senator woman or whatever she was in.
Yeah, same thing.
The Boys, same sort of skill, right?
Yeah.
Because they have this a similar power, right?
Well, and it's funny because they were relying on her and the boys to be the sort of the thing that might be able to stop Homelander. So here now we've essentially created a stand-in, right?
Yeah. And demonstrated that there is that potential to take out just about anybody, really. Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean,
overall... and Godolkin was like, he was having his way with the young kids, like the supposed class or whatever of misfits that he put together. And then even once the people show up in the Trojan, you know, escape, they...
That character's name is actually Black Hole, if you can believe it.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, given that, you know, they can fit that many people...
there.
Yeah, there. Yeah.
But they're trying to give too much away.
Yeah. Yeah. But, no, again, like I said, there's a lot to like there. It's cool that they're expanding this universe. But I, as much as I love this, it's not The Boys, and I can't wait for The Boys to come back.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. When are we getting The Boys back, you know?
I believe next year is when they're supposed to air the final season. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it was, overall, it was a good season. I enjoyed this season a bit more than the first season, to be honest with you. I don't know how you feel about that, but
yeah, I mean,
or maybe the amount of time that's gone by kind of thing. It did seem a little silly that it's kind of like, you know, they're in school and therefore they're sort of protected, and, you know, cause I mean, if Homelander showed up, he could just sort of wipe the slate, you know?
Well, yeah, I will say the one thing I didn't like about the season compared to the first one is that I thought the first one was more centered around the sort of the university life, the sort of the challenges of young people. There was a little more identifiable element here. This season, they kind of went off campus a lot more. There was other places, other things. It wasn't really like in this episode, they talked about like the top 10 list and everything else again. And it was like, oh yeah, I forgot they were doing that. And that's not a good sign when you're talking about what was a central element to the first episode. And even, you know, a little bit at the beginning of this season, but they didn't really keep things focused on that university life. I would say if you were interested in it because it was like these people, this age, this time in your life, everything else, this was a bit of a departure from the first season, not necessarily in a bad way. And I will say they landed the plane nicely. We talked after the first few episodes about how they did a pretty good job of honoring Chase Perdomo, who had died tragically in his motorcycle accident. And they did a good thing by his character, you know, noble death and everything else. Even here, you know, there's a good moment with the person that was possessed by Godolkin saying like, oh, you know, I still have all my memories. I remember your son. You'd have been so proud of him. He was such a good kid. He worked hard. He did all this stuff. They really did well by that character and by proxy, the actor himself, so that, you know, you're left with positive feelings from a tragedy. And that's not an easy lift, especially because, you know, obviously this entire season would have been completely different, I'm sure, if they hadn't had to deal with, you know, writing an entire character out and dealing with his death and everything else. So, yeah, I thought they managed that quite well. Yeah.
All right, well, let's move on to the watch list. And you've got a bunch of things up here. Well, let me guess.
Let's talk about Stranger Things season 3. I continue my rewatch of Stranger Things, season 3 was always one I really enjoyed. Season 3 is the first episode that doesn't take place in the fall. The first two seasons are sort of set around Halloween, and here we are in summertime, and it's summertime in Hawkins, Indiana, and this is the one with the mall, so, you know, there's a lot of stuff going on there. This is the one where we get introduced to the Russians, have infiltrated the town and everything. And the kids have gotten to a point of maturity now where, like, you know, Mike and Elle are dating, and, you know, like, things are sort of in a different place, and... I enjoyed this season. This is the one where, you know, they introduced Maya Hawke's character, and they're working at the ice cream parlor. She and Steve are working together at the ice cream parlor. There's just a lot of fun, sort of quirky moments mixed in with the horror and the adventure and everything else. It doesn't advance the plot stupendously. There's still no, like, it feels like season four was the real sort of move ahead. The first three seasons, it's like, well, there's this place, and the place is the bad guy, and the place, the upside down, is the big bad, and the monsters that come out of the big bad. But there's no sort of sense of, like, you know, oh, there's something larger. And then they introduce the idea of the mind flare in season two. And then here we get the sort of the physical manifestation of the mind flare, but it still doesn't feel like there's a personality to the monstrosity. It's not till season four that we get introduced to the concept of Vecna, and that there's actually a person behind this, and then we get the backstory and everything else. So here it still feels like by the time you get to season three, you're like, okay, so they're in threat again, and it's an interesting story, but also it still feels like a monster movie and not like a big picture, you know, it's all coming together. I really feel like I'm looking forward to seeing season four again, because that's where I feel like we kind of moved into the setup for season five, where, oh, there's actually a brain behind all this, not just sort of monstrous animosity or anything else. So yeah, I think three holds up really well and sets the stage for season four. And I'm going to dive into that. I've got about 4 weeks left to try and power through that so that we can get ready for our season five. Couple things I wanted to mention that are coming up. So Star Wars Visions, the series, so this is season three. This is the series that sees animation studios working on different sort of alternate takes on the mythology of Star Wars and the concepts that Lucas and his cohorts have created. The first season, of course, was all done by Japanese animation studios. The second season was done by international studios. And here we're returning to the Japanese studios, including continuing some of the stories that were created as shorts for the first season. So just dropped yesterday, so I haven't had a chance to break into it. I know we all enjoyed, not all of it, but I think most of what we saw the first one. So I'm looking forward to jumping into that this weekend as well. And a little sneaky drop here from Disney Plus. They quietly announced yesterday that next week we're going to get Fantastic Four First Steps is dropping on Disney Plus on November 5th. So if you haven't had a chance to make it to the theater, hi, May, then you'll be able to go and watch Fantastic Four First Steps, which definitely will play a part in the next chunk of Marvel movies as far as sort of what the next thing is. I thought it was a good movie. I didn't think it was a great movie. I think that it'll benefit from a second watch to sort of see how I feel about it again. So I'll make some time for that as well.
Did you see it in a theater?
I did. I saw that one. I had to go down to St. John on business, so I actually saw that in a nice Cineplex theater that they have in St. John, New Brunswick.
Did you see it in 3D?
I did not.
So I saw it in 3D with, and I was in that one where they shake the chairs or whatever, I'll never go to again. It just so happened there was an early ticket, and you know, before it was the day before it was going to launch. But what's interesting about it, it's been on iTunes for, or it's been on the Apple Store for or TV Store, whatever. What do we call it? I'm going to call it iTunes. Let's call it that. the whatever store. Has been available. And as you know, because I have a Vision Pro, I can see when things are in 3D or not. And it's not in 3D on the App Store, Apple Store, right on the iTunes Store. So I wonder if it's going to be... Disney Plus has always been really good about showing their content in 3D.
Mm.
So it'll be interesting to see if they serve it up to us in 3D or not. Because it was very good in 3D. It had a lot of stuff going on for it. But
Yeah.
Yeah, it blowed up real good that way. So
you let us know next week.
I will let you know as soon as it drops, and I'll add it to my list of 3D movies that are available. I did find a site actually that lists movies that are in 3D as well, and you can put your country in; it'll show whether or not the title's in there. But and you know that saga I was telling you about the 3D stuff disappearing from Vision Pro. I got a feedback on my article that I posted. There's another person who like had hundreds of movies that they had put together for Vision Pro, and very many. All the Transformer movies were in 3D initially, but now they're all in 2D. And so he did complain, and Apple did restore the 3D versions of them, of some of them. But he thinks that, or they think that, this seems to be something about the rights holders, because now there's more like all the. Because I did notice that Bumblebee at one point was in 3D, and then when it came over to Disney Plus, it was not. So, which I thought, that's odd, right? So, but I'm not sure if it's a Paramount movie or not, but. Yeah. And some of the Paramount, you know, it's not necessarily just Paramount, because there are some movies that are owned by Paramount that are in 3D, like animated ones, that appear in 3D. Anyway, enough of that. When I was in London, I was going through the British Museum where they're just down the road from where the Rosetta Stone was, in that same area. I was looking at some Egyptian, sculptures, you know, from back in the day, which we all studied in university. So, you know, it's the kind of thing when you get to see one in real life, you go and check it out, right? And it hadn't dawned on me at the time I was wearing my, you know, Strange New Worlds t-shirt, and one of the guards started whistling the Alexander Courage theme behind me. And I just sort of like, why was somebody? And then it went, oh, wait a minute, he's whistling because I'm wearing my t-shirt, right? So I went over and talked to him a bit, and I talked about the fact that we have this podcast and we do Star Trek stuff and whatever. And he said, you should look into Blake 7. Now, I did watch Blake 7. Like, I would flip by Blake 7 when it was on Space or PBS or whatever. And it's from 78, I think. It was around the same time as Star Wars, or just about a year after Star Wars, right? And so I sort of said to Jonathan, maybe we should, you know, if we're looking for something to rewatch, maybe all three of us could sit down and watch Blake 7. It's on BritBox, and which is like $10 a month or something, or 50 cents a month in the US for Jaime. But when I was sort of telling you guys about it, I happened to notice that on YouTube, somebody's posted season one, episode one. So it's called The Way Back. And so I sat down and watched it. What I found was really interesting is there's a story by Philip K. Dick called We Can Remember It For You Wholesale, which was the basis for the movie Total Recall, right? And Total Recall was 1990. So this was 1973. The Philip K. Dick book was 69. And here, the main character, Blake, without giving too much away, because, I mean, there's four seasons, so I don't think I'm giving much. I don't know anything else about the rest of the seasons, but I found it interesting. I thought it was really well written. So even though it's 1979 British sci-fi, so it's rough, you know, but, and they don't go for a whole lot of like Doctor Who kind of like plastic, you know, video effects and stuff like that. It's more of a sort of an underground movement. There's a, sort of a rebellion against the state kind of thing. And the state is manipulating people and putting, suppressants in their food, and, you know, keeping them drugged and that kind of stuff to keep them in line. And this Blake person was a some sort of leader in such a great sense that when he got turned in, they erased his mind, erased his memory. And then this team of rebels finds him and says, you know, you were the big leader kind of guy. And rather than killing you off and making you a martyr to the cause, they just wiped your brain, which they have the technology to do, right? So it's very similar to the whole idea behind Total Recall, the movie, where, you know, we find out the guy's like, hey, you know, I had this sort of idea, and his wife is actually there to keep an eye on him kind of thing, right? Yeah, so, I mean, I don't know if you saw the Colin Farrell version of it. It's pretty good, too, but it's a remake of the Arnold Schwarzenegger movie. But, yeah, I just thought, like, I'd be interested to see what you think, Jonathan. It's only, like, 40 minutes long. This episode, if you watched it, and tell me if I'm wrong about the writing being good, you know,
I will take a look.
Yeah, because it's you know, it's the trope of the, you know, rebellion and all that kind of stuff. But the acting is good and the writing is good. It's not. I don't think the dialogue was too hokey, you know, kind of thing, like as you would expect from a Doctor Who or, you know, or other shows from that era. So I just thought it showed promise, you know. And the other thing, so Down Cemetery Road just showed up on Apple TV yesterday. Well, they dropped two episodes, and this is written by Mick Herron, and it's Zoe Boehm is the name of the character. He's the author of Slow Horses, as you may remember, that Jonathan and I both love, is one of the best shows on TV. And I think we just finished season 5, right? Just had the finale the other day. Super well written. This is very similar in that sense, same sense. It's, of course, now I'm going to have a brain fart. It's Ruth Wilson and Emma Thompson. Emma Thompson plays Zoe Boehm. She's the private detective. And Ruth Wilson in this one is sort of the client who's hiring the detective kind of thing. But the first two episodes have, both of them have ended up on the first two episodes have ended on cliffhangers, right? So, and it's very well written. It takes place in Oxford as opposed to, and London, a little bit of London too. But it's that very same sort of, well-written, suspenseful sort of, not a spy novel like the Mick Herron thing. Oh, and the other thing too, I thought was interesting too, is I listened to a podcast called We Regret to Inform You. Its subtitle is The Rejection Podcast. And they talk about people who have tried, you hear this story a lot. I mean, they did an episode on Stephen King. They've done one on Mick Herron and Slow Horses. And this particular episode I will link in here is the story of how he was writing this. He wrote this book nobody would publish it. And somebody took a chance on it, didn't do really well. And then he wrote some other stuff, and then somebody in the U.S. got a hold of it and decided, oh, this is such a good thing. And then they basically bought the rights and that turned it into the Apple TV Plus show. In fact, they didn't think Apple TV Plus would take this on because it's a British spy drama, right? So it's a really interesting episode about, the how Mick Herron went from this guy who was writing, wanted to be a writer, wrote this stuff, and then Slow Horses kind of took off. And that's when he started to... He's written like 6 or 8 books. I kick in myself because Waterstones is one of the places I buy books from in the state in the UK. They had signed copies of his latest Slough House series, right?
Yeah.
The latest one of his books, they had signed copies and I didn't pick one up. So, oh well. Hmm. And they weren't outrageously priced. They were a pretty good price. But anyway, that's, for next time. Next time I go to the UK or whatever.
Yep.
All right. So, and we'll head over to Jaime for his pick.
Yeah. My significant other and I, we got around to watching Neja, the 2019 Chinese animated film based on, I think, some sort of historical, like we would use in the West a lot of Greek and Roman mythology, right? It's some story mythology from China. And it's pretty interesting as a movie about a sort of demon child born of like really convoluted circumstances, like, world-changing kind of circumstances. Was of interest to us because folks might remember on this very show, we talked about the news article about Neja 2, the sequel to this movie, which we've not seen yet, that had a global box office of over 2.1 billion, which made it like, I think, the highest grossing animated film of all time. Mm-hmm. And certainly the biggest movie of this calendar year, 2025. So we wanted to see what all the hype was, but said, well, we kind of want to know what we're getting into. So let's go watch the original. And we found it on Netflix. So it's pretty good, pretty breezy. It's kind of interesting to see how the animation is done a little differently, for the East than it is for the West. So I appreciated the fact that this didn't feel like, oh, yeah, that feels like a Pixar movie, or, oh, that feels like a DreamWorks, film. It feels very different, which I appreciated.
You'll have to find me a link for that because I can't find it anywhere.
Oh, man, is it not on Canadian Netflix?
I can't even find it on IMDb.
I looked for it too after we talked about that episode, Jaime, and I didn't see it available here. So it might be an American Netflix thing.
Let's see.
Yeah, but even if you just give me the link, then I can put it in the show notes for the folks driving it, transporting it home.
Just Watch says for Canadians.
It's Nezha, right?
Nezha.
Yeah.
No Zha.
Zha. It looks like Prime Video.
That's why.
It should be on Prime Video for y'all.
Oh, But it, why would it not? Why does it show up in the IMDb database? That's weird. Oh, yeah. Just something does come up. There it is.
Okay.
Yep. Okay.
Good.
Cool.
There you go.
Thanks.
Yeah, the international rights stuff always gets really hairy with this stuff.
Oh, I seen the Neha 2 character, like that little girl with the...
Yeah, the little boy, Neja, kind of has like a staff and other accoutrements that feel a whole lot like the Sun Wukong character, the monkey king from Journey to the West. So it feels like, again, it certainly does seem like it's based on some actual mythology that is there. It wasn't like whole cloth made up by the artists, but it's foreign to me, so it feels more new and innovative because of that. I think I mentioned that K-pop Demon Hunters on Netflix, since, you know, I don't know Korean mythology very well, it's immensely innovative. So I'll see what it's like for Neja 2 when we get a chance to watch that.
I did find it eventually on IMDb. I guess they have this sort of rabbit hole you can go down, and you have to go back to the home section to get back to the proper search. Makes no sense. Bad application. Bad user experience.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, I guess that's it for another week. So, hey, Jonathan, people want to get in touch with you. Where would they find you?
Oh, you can look on Blue Sky or Instagram. I'm at JPK News, or you can look at YouTube, youtube.com/@JPK.
Right. And for Jaime, who want to look up Jaime, where would you find him?
I'm on Instagram as @devthehair.
I just thought, as I introduced Jonathan, I should probably do the Jedi mind trick thing, right? yeah, and my name is Timitra, TimMitra, and you want to find me on Blue Sky, on Mastodon. And until next time, we'll see you in the future. Bye.
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 You've been listening to the Spotcast Podcast. If you want to find out more about the podcast or see the episode show notes, visit the Spotcast website at spotcast.com. If you have feedback or questions, you can get in touch with us on the website. If you like the show, please consider recommending us to a friend, writing a review on iTunes, or pledging any amount at patreon.com/spotcast. You can find details on how to help us on our website, spotcast.com/sponsor us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you in the future.
All we need.
Just yeah. 1 out of 2. A lot of pressure on the Dodgers. They have to, away from home, win 2 in a row. So look at it that way.
Well, the Blue Jays did it.
Great.
Look at it that way.
Yep. I don't know. It's funny because I remember you and I watched the 92 World Series in your basement. And I remember sitting there with you and we're watching it. We may have been playing some Sega Genesis hockey while watching it.
Okay.
And, but I remember explicitly because the Blue Jays up until 92, they had these series of like Maple Leaf-esque letdowns where it was like 85, we made it. We finally won the AL East. It's so great. And then we choked it in the ALCS against the Kansas City. We choked up a lead and then lost. It was a heartbreaker. 87, we had, we led the AL East right down to the last week of the season, lost every single game the last week of the season. The Tigers won the division and we didn't even make the playoffs. 89, they made it to the playoffs again and they got their butts kicked in the ALCS again. So by the time we got to 92, I just had no faith. I was just like, I was waiting for the rug to be pulled on me. So we were watching Game 6 and it was in Atlanta. And I remember watching Otis Nixon bunt. And I remember Timlin coming off the mound and throwing it to Joe Carter. And Joe starts jumping up and down and they won. And I remember just looking at you and going, huh, they won. I wasn't excited. I was just like, wow, they actually did it. And I think that speaks to the trauma of being a Toronto sports fan over the years, where you just kind of always waiting for the shoe to drop. And even as I was really enjoying the last couple of games and watching them, you know, battle back and take on this terrific Dodgers team, I still find myself in that same boat where I'm like, I don't believe it's true until it's done. Like, it just doesn't feel real, you know. And I had the same feeling in the when the Raptors were going too. It was like so exciting, but also like, oh, but it never works out for us. There's no way. I'm sure Seattle must have a trauma on you guys as well, Jaime, of the same thing. Although the Seahawks at least won a title in the last 20 years. So,
yeah, there's. Degrees there. I think somebody had put like, and you all are the hockey fans, that it's been a while since any Canadian team has won the NHL Stanley
93
Cup.
93 was the last time that okay. A Canadian team won at all. That was Montreal.
There we go. Yeah, that's
Patrick Roy, right?
Patrick Roy was unbelievable that year. And that was the year that we got cheated out of the Toronto-Montreal final because Gretzky heisted Gilmore, and that's the one that sticks in every
Carey Fraser.
Yep. Never. We always remember the referee who was staring right at it as it happened and did not make the call.
Yeah.
Wayne Gretzky, of all people, who was not a dirty player, accidentally high-sticked Doug Gilmore in the face and cut him. Which in that era was a 5-minute penalty and a game misconduct. So not only would he have been given a 5-minute power play to the Leafs, but he would have been kicked out of the game. And he didn't make that call. And then Gretzky beat the Leafs. And then Gretzky went to the finals and got killed by Patrick Roy and the Canadiens. And everyone in Canada was just praying for one last Toronto-Montreal Stanley Cup final, like the good old days. And we I think all of us still feel the loss of that one.
And that was the team that could have gone too. That
was a terrific team. That was a terrific Leafs team. They were really, really, really competitive. Gilmore was, you know, arguably the second best player in the league that year next to Mario Lemieux, and they could have won it all. And it really, I think that one's still the one that stings the most, because I feel like that was the closest we came. But yeah, it's funny how you just, you know, it does wear you down. I feel like my Maple Leaf fandom has really just, you know, it's worn me out as a sports fan overall, where I'm like, I just don't have faith that it's going to work out until it works out. Although I should, again, I also root for the Canadian hockey team, and I root for the German football soccer team. You'd think that I'd be okay, that I've seen my teams win some titles, but nope, still don't believe it till it's done. Yep, so it'll be white knuckle time tomorrow. I'm deeply envious of my brother, who has tickets to go see tomorrow night's game, Jaime.
Does he?
Yeah, my big brother Dave has tickets for himself, his wife, and his daughter to go see this game. I am curious though, Tim, I wanted to ask you this, because we can cut this part of the podcast, but wasn't his daughter supposed to go to like ballet practice tomorrow night? Like, how are they working that out?
She's not going, I guess.
If she's not going, I'd raise your hand, because not often you get to see the possibility of watching a team win a title. But he told me when I saw him last weekend, he said he got 6 tickets to see the playoffs. He went to game one, and they watched the first good game against the Dodgers, and then they went, and he said he bought 3 tickets for game one and 3 tickets for game 6.
Really? Wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah. Hmm. So, and again, they're up on.
Well, she's in a nutcracker this year, so I don't think, and she's not like riding horses, because you can't, you know, get injured if you're in that kind of at that level.
Yep. What about being in a spontaneous celebration after a world championship baseball game?
What time's the game at? 8?
8 your time, yeah.
Yeah. No, I hadn't heard. A friend of mine was looking for tickets for one of his customers too. So
yeah. As of last night, like, to sit in the 500s, we're selling for about $1,500 to $1,800 a ticket, and that was to sit like up in the nosebleeds.
Well, those tickets I got, I could have sold them for several thousand dollars.
Oh, easily.
Yeah.
I mean, it's cool. Like, everyone should try and have one of those like once in a lifetime experiences. You know, again, like you and I sat on the glass at Maple Leaf Gardens and watched that game once, and that was unbelievable, right? Like,
and we got to carry the flag last time we went to a Leaf game, right? Because that flag that goes flying over top of you.
Yeah.
I got those from the people I worked for when I did that special project.
Jaime, what's the best sporting event you've ever been to?
Well, I saw Wayne Gretzky's 3 times.
Yeah, me too.
I'm going to have to think of this one. Have I seen... Man, I don't know if I'm imagining this in my head. I'm pretty sure... I'm going to have to look up the facts on this. So in... What year was it? It must be like 2006-ish when Ichiro Suzuki had the... Like, he ended up tying and then later on breaking and extending the...
Oh, all-time hits in a season?
Most hits in a season. I'm pretty sure I was there when he hit like 257, 258, whichever one tied, or I don't think I saw him break it. I think that happened the next night.
Yeah. That's still pretty cool. I mean, Ichiro is one of my favorite players. I love base hitters. I love slap singles. I love guys that play like that. I love Ichiro Suzuki. I think he's an amazing ball player.
Pretty sure I was also there for, and it's kind of less cool now because of like Roy's era tainting everything. I'm pretty sure I was there on the third base side in some pretty good seats when Rafael Palmeiro and the Orioles got the Mr. 3000 Club.
Oh, yeah. That's cool. I'm
pretty sure I was there for that one. I was there for something where they, like, you know, stopped the game and celebrated for, like, you know, it's a big achievement, even though it's a opponent.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, Tim and I went to see the World, what do they call it? Canada Cup in 91 and saw this, like, all-star team of Canadians, including Wayne Gretzky and Marc Messier and all these iconic Hall of Fame players play all on the same team. And that was the game where Eric Lindros hit Ulf Samuelsson so hard he broke his collarbone, which I don't know if you know hockey well enough, Jaime, but Ulf Samuelsson was one of the dirtiest players of the 90s. He very famously kneed the captain of the year, or the assistant captain of the Boston Bruins, Cam Neely, and basically ended his career. He screwed up his knee and he was never the same. And everybody hated his guts. And Eric Lindros was this humongous, strapping Canadian kid, 6'4", 230, just built like a, you know, brick outhouse. And he ran him into the boards on a fair check, and he hit him so hard he snapped his collarbone. So that was quite a thing to see live and in person, because he just went down in a heap and they had to carry him off.
Wow.
And the most random thing I've ever seen was I was for a while there. I have stopped since it's been more challenging over the most recent years. But I've been to 16, I think, different ballparks in Major League Baseball. When I was traveling for work, I would always go. If I was somewhere, I would always try and go see a game. And so a couple friends and I decided to drive down because they were going to close Tiger Stadium, the old stadium in Detroit. And I thought, you know, I got to see this place before they tear it down. Now, when I got there, I realized why they were tearing it down. It was the most disgusting little rat box I've ever been to. Literally rat box. There were rats. The whole place smelled like urine. It was terrible. It was terrible. But we were there and they were playing the then California Angels. And the guy who was pitching for them that day, I can't remember if it was Mark Langston or Charlie Finley. It was one of their two best pitchers at the time. Threw an inning where he struck out the first three batters. So he struck out the side, but on the last guy he struck out, the ball got away from the catcher and the runner ran down to first base. So he got three strikeouts. And then they got to bring a fourth guy up and he struck out the fourth guy. And it was only like the sixth time in baseball history that someone struck out four batters in an inning.
Wow, that's crazy. Which
is pretty random, right? Like, what are the odds of seeing somebody? Because you have to have that exact circumstance. Somebody has to get on in a weird way. But yeah, this guy struck out four batters in one inning. Still, actually, as I sit here, I'm looking down. On my desk, the cup that I use to hold my pens and pencils and markers and stuff is my drink cup from that day at Tiger Stadium. I still have it right here. It says right on it, Tiger Stadium, 1999.
Very cool. Very cool.
Well, Jaime, I hope you're rooting for us tomorrow. Hope we have your best wishes. Or if you're busy and watching cats, I'll understand.
Yeah, we'll see how things go. Wish you all the best. And again, make sure you're going to have to, you know, should you be victorious, you're going to have to make sure you participate in the festivities.
It's so weird because I've never... I was actually away in college when they won the second one. And that felt really weird. to be away from it. It really feels weird because I'm now so much further away. Now, there have been watch parties. There's lots of this Canada's team, right? That's the only team we have in this country. So everybody's a Blue Jays fan. So there's lots of support here. But it still feels weird to be like, my God, they could have a parade next week and I wouldn't even be able to go. Like, that sucks. Yeah. No, I don't think I'd fly back for a parade, but it definitely feels really weird to not have the option, you know?
You can't road trip it. You can't, you know.
I just did that road trip last weekend, and that was the, I think, eighth time I've done it this year because of the move. I'm like, I can't. It's 1,200 kilometers. It's like 14 hours of driving each time. I'm like, I just can't. I just can't do it. It's too much. Even on the way back this time, I was like, oh, I'm so glad I don't have to do this drive again until, like, hopefully spring. It's just too much.
Yeah. What year did the Raptors win?
2019.
Okay. Yep. I have a picture here somewhere.
Yeah, I mean, Zave and I went to the beginning of that parade, which was great because it was way less of a zoo. It got really out of control in the afternoon.
Yeah, I was downtown just outside my office, basically.
Yeah, yeah. We were right outside the X where it started because we basically took the GO train in and just stood like right there where it was starting, which was great because like it came to a dead stop because it was so congested. It came to a dead stop where we're standing there. It's so slow that Xavier walked over with his phone and took a selfie with Masai Ujiri. Like he actually has a selfie of him like with Masai, like looking over his shoulder. Yeah. So that was a pretty fun experience too. Again, you just never know when these things are going to happen, right? Like you root for years, and you know you just kind of hope. Again, I still don't know that I'm ever going to see a Maple Leafs championship. I've been lucky enough to see all the other Toronto teams that I root for do it. I've seen Canada win gold medals in sports that I care about. I've seen the German team hoist the World Cup a couple times. So, all things being equal, I've been pretty lucky as a sports fan. But, you know, you grow up with the blue and white in your blood, and it just poisons you over the years. It really does.
Jonathan, if you look on the Friends of the Show channel, I just posted some pictures. I think one of them's yours.
Yeah, that one of Kawhi with the statue over his head's mine. The first one.
Yeah.
And that third one is Steve Russell's. Or no, that's Canadian Press. That's who would have taken that for Canadian Press?
I don't know, but if you look at the first one I put up there, it's a panorama.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. That's cool.
That's like Young and, or sorry, Union Station.
Yeah, yeah, you can see it.
Waiting for them to come up and just turning.
Yeah.
You know, so many people were there.
Well, you can see how much closer we were because that one of, like, Kawhi, he's on the top of that double-decker bus and probably 15 feet away.
Mm-hmm.
Got really lucky as far as where we happened to be. Yep.
Cool. All right.
Well, let's stay in touch this week and we can decide next week what we want to do.
Sure.
Yeah, like I say, not
okay.
I mean, other than Jaime's full and thorough review of Cats for the next episode too.
True.
I'm thinking of going with like the quotes. The elevator pitch, the quotes, Easter eggs if I can find them, and pew pew pew, and see how it fits that structure.
Yeah.
Yep. And whether or not you stabbed your eyes out halfway through.
Right.
All right.
Okay, talk to you later.
All right, take care, guys.
Talk to you later.
Bye.
Go Leafs, go. Bye. Go Jays, go.